You know the story about the frog in a pot?
Yeah.
If there's boiling water in the pot and you throw the frog there, the frog will jump out, right? But if you warm the water up steadily, that's exactly what happened to the Russian society.
Freedom of speech.
Fundamental rights.
Freedom of conscience.
Academic freedom.
Freedom of press.
And the right to listen.
You're listening to So to Speak, the Free Speech Podcast, brought to you by FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression.
All right, folks, welcome back to So to Speak, the Free Speech Podcast, where every other week we take an uncensored look at the world of free expression through personal stories and candid conversations. I am, as always, your host, Nico Perino. And it was just over 2 years ago that Russia invaded Ukraine. And on this podcast, we covered the invasion. We explored how Russia was purging independent media, banning protests, and shutting down social media access in order to control the narrative and limit dissent within the country. Today, we're going to revisit the situation in Russia. The war in Ukraine is still raging. And to join us, we have two very special guests who are experts on all things Russia. We have Yevgeny Simkin, also known as Jenya. Yevgeny is a technologist. He's a thinker, musician, comedian. He fled Soviet Russia as a child and has spent the last 30 years dabbling around the bleeding edges of the internet, ITV, and mobile technologies. And after Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022, Yevgeny and his co-founder, Michael Sprague, launched Samizdat Online, which is an anti-censorship platform whose custom tech allows users to read and send materials from sites that various dictatorships block inside their nations. Yevgeny, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also joining us is Stanislav Kucher. Stanislav, also known as Stas, is a Russian and American journalist. He's a media manager and filmmaker with 30 years of experience covering Russian domestic and foreign policy. He has covered numerous conflicts with the Putin administration, and he has interviewed all of the top Russian politicians from Mikhail Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin to Vladimir Putin and Alexei Navalny. Kucher is now editor-in-chief of Samizdat Online and a contributor to the Cypher Brief. Stas, welcome onto the show.
Thank you, Nikki.
So I think we should start with the biggest news of the moment, which is the death of Alexei Navalny. He was pronounced dead on February 16th of this year while serving a 19-year prison sentence on charges of extremism. And he was serving that sentence in the IK3 penal colony north of the Arctic Circle, which is about 1,200 miles northeast of Moscow. It sounds very cold. What's your initial reaction, Stas? You've interviewed the man before. It seems like you know him pretty well. Does this surprise you?
No surprise, but it was a huge shock. Yeah. It's like, I mean, what else do you expect when a person is first poisoned and then thrown to prison for 19 years, and then held in solitary confinement 300 times in the course of the 2.5 years he's been in prison. So, I mean, everybody thought that this would eventually happen. But of course, at the same time, everybody, myself included, had hoped that this would become an exception to the rule, yeah, and that he will survive and somehow repeat the story of Nelson Mandela, you know, mm-hmm, serve his prison sentence and then reemerged on the surface as the nation's savior and became president. So it was a great shock to me because, yes, I did know Alexei personally. I've known him since 2007.
Yeah. Do you think he knew something like this was likely?
There's no way we can get into his head, right? Obviously, he knew this was a possibility. Yeah. And he obviously knew there was a high risk of them killing him. Actually, when we use the word death, I would rather use the word killing.
Yeah, murder.
He was killed, murdered, assassinated, whatever verb you pick will be correct.
Well, what we're told happened is that he went on a walk, right? And then he just fell down dead? We're supposed to believe that?
I think it's highly irrelevant what we're told. The nature of this regime and regimes like it is that they say whatever it is that they need everybody to repeat within their own nation. I don't think that they expect anybody outside their nation. Putin does not think that he's not naive.
Yeah.
He doesn't think that anybody outside the nation is going to believe that this man just fell over dead, but also even if he did just fall over and die, right? Like the conditions, first, when you go and you try and you poison somebody and they miraculously survive because of the intervention of the West, then already you were guilty of at least attempted murder. And then subsequently you take this man who's not fully recovered and you throw him in an incredibly hostile and difficult situation such as the prison system of Russia. Like that, it doesn't matter what the actual, you know, what biologically finished him is not the issue.
Sure.
I mean, he was definitely tortured there and tormented and tortured. And again, I hope you never make it as a visitor to solitary confinement. But I've been to Russian prisons. And trust me, even a healthy young person is likely to suffer severe consequences to his health.
Is there no accountability for poor treatment in Russia? I mean, presumably you would have lawyers get involved here in the United States.
Well, the lawyers got involved and they repeatedly asked the prison authorities to, not to take him to solitary confinement in the first place. Uh-huh. And every time he was taken there, they'll be under some stupid excuse, like he didn't salute the guard, for example, or he was 30 seconds late to stand up in the morning, mm-hmm. and so on. So every time, I mean, excuses were really stupid, and the conditions he was kept under were torturous. So just like Zhenya said, no matter what actually happened in the moment, was it a clot that suddenly killed him? It's obviously the regime and Putin that killed him. Because if they wanted him alive, they could have put him in different conditions.
Sure.
It's interesting. It just occurred to me that you guys are mostly a legal organization, so this question is actually really pertinent. The way that Putin's regime in particular operates is that they try to make sure that everything is under some statute, right? Like they will craft the law as necessary, mm-hmm. in order to make sure that when it comes time to be accused of having done something, they will say, well, the law is this way. Meanwhile, they've just adjusted it in order for it to be that way. But the point is that they are very concerned about jurisprudence. I met with, I'm forgetting his last name, Pasha, the one of the main human rights lawyers.
Chikov.
Thank you.
Pavel Chikov. He's a famous lawyer and human rights activist, former member of Putin's Council on Civic Rights and the development of human rights and the development of civic society. There is even such an institution under Putin called President's Human Rights Council.
Which sounds farcical, right? So, and I asked him, how are you guys operating in this environment where you're desperately chasing after, it's a whack-a-mole game where the laws keep changing and they are working to advocate for people who are standing up to Putin's regime. And he says, primarily, even though it does feel completely futile in the moment, primarily it's just that there is a full record, right? Like there's a very, very deep and thorough history of everything that's been done, so that when these people finally, hopefully, face some kind of justice, there will be, it won't be whimsical. It won't be like, let's just throw them on the gallows, right? Like there will be evidence.
Yeah. Wasn't the Soviet Union known for being very bureaucratic and taking a lot of notes, and there was a lot of records of what they did just because that was kind of the culture?
Just like any autocracy. Any autocracy is famous for red tape.
Yeah. So what is the state of the opposition inside Russia now without Alexei Navalny? He was the main opposition leader, right? I mean, is there any opposition to the Putin regime within Russia right now?
It depends on how you define opposition. Mm-hmm. Of course, there is nobody like Alexei Navalny right now at large in Russia.
Yeah.
Okay. Two other very famous opposition leaders. One is Ilya Yashin, who was also a friend of Alexei Navalny. He's in prison now. Okay. And another one you might have heard of is Vladimir Kara-Murza, who lived here in this country and helped Boris Nemtsov and Alexei Navalny. Boris Nemtsov is another Russian opposition leader who was assassinated in front of the Kremlin on February 27th, 2015. So Vladimir Kara-Murza and Ilya Yashin and some other famous opposition activists are in prison. And all those who can call themselves oppositionists and who are still free, they're not real opposition. Like Boris Nadezhdin, who tried to run for president, and he did not make it to the ballot. But he was what is called a Kremlin project. So they wanted him to participate in the first place when they saw, you know, huge lines of people ready to put their signatures for him. And they realized, okay, all those people are against the war, because that's what Nadezhdin's claim was, that I'm against the war in Ukraine.
Yeah.
So once the Kremlin realized what the picture looked, and the picture did not look nice to them, so that's when they just took him off the ballot. So he never made it to the election. And right now, on the eve of the March presidential election, we have Vladimir Putin and three other candidates who have zero chances. Like literally zero chances of winning, no matter if the election is free or if it's what it is in Russia at the moment. So no, there is no actual opposition in Russia.
Well, I want to interject and contradict slightly, because opposition comes in multiple forms.
Sure, right? A bunch of people showed up to Alexei Navalny's funeral.
So for example, Navalny's widow is now kind of the face of the opposition, but also the organization, the Anti-Corruption Foundation. They have been a very, they're a force for oppositional endeavors, yeah, so to speak. But the thing that we built and the thing that we're promoting, and the main reason why we're on this wonderful show, is that the primary opposition in any situation of this nature is the press. Right, it's the and we'll get into how the Western press has lost its plot a little bit in the last couple of decades. But the press in places like Russia, it's a very distinct dichotomy between the press that simply obeys the regime and they're just a mouthpiece for the regime, and they will simply repeat whatever the regime tells them to repeat, mm-hmm. And the oppositional press, who operate usually outside the borders of the nation, because they're all literally criminals by virtue of the things that they are now saying, right? They've been dubbed, what is the expression? There's a legal term for it.
It's called undesirable organization.
Right, undesirable organization, which is a...
These are the press organizations.
This is the press organization, okay. And individuals, right? So
are you guys undesirable individuals?
I have yet to earn that distinction. I'm hopeful that will come.
Yeah, we're yet to earn this formal distinction.
Yeah.
But informally, of course, we are undesirable there. Uh-huh. And that's actually why Samizdat Online was... banned by Russia's main censorship governmental body, Roskomnadzor, mm-hmm. On Christmas Eve 2022. So, I mean, back to opposition, the thing is, again, Zhen is right, there is no politically structured resistance in Russia, which is normally what we call opposition, right, in any country,
yeah.
Political opposition. You have Democrats in the White House, then you have Republicans in the House of Representatives here. So in Russia, there is literally no structured political opposition to Vladimir Putin. But of course, there are voices of what is called in Russia несогласные, which means those who don't agree with the government, with the Kremlin. So there are voices of those несогласные, both inside Russia and those voices which come into Russia from outside.
Well, how many voices are there that do not agree? Like, can we get a read?
As people or as media? As media.
As people. Like, what does the population actually think? It's gotta be hard to get a true reading.
It is impossible to get a true reading, right? So you can, there's tea leaf reading. But a true reading in a nation like Russia, where there is literally a 7 to 15 year prison sentence for anybody who calls what they are calling a military operation a war, right? Like, that's it. That's the level of transgression that you need to do in order to end up in prison, right? So moving on.
And that's enforced. People are going to prison for opposing the war.
They are.
Or for calling it war.
And I don't have the numbers on that, but they are. And the thing is that there's obviously what do we call it, chilling effect, right? It doesn't matter how many, you don't need to have a lot of people being sent to prison for calling it a war. Everybody understands what the reality is. So when pollsters either call or see somebody on the street and say, how do you feel about Vladimir Putin? There's literally no incentive, to be honest, at all, right? Like your only incentive is to avoid hassle and to avoid being questioned or tried or any of these things are greatly undesirable, and then going to prison is extremely undesirable. So there's really no way to know. But it
is.
No,
excuse me. Like I have a friend, and he doesn't favor the war. Actually, he's participated in all of Navalny's opposition rallies in Moscow. So what happened just 4 weeks ago? He gets a phone call from one of those Kremlin-controlled polling agencies. Mm-hmm. And he's asked this question, you know, are you ready to participate in our poll? And by the way, mind that all conversations are being recorded for and so on. And then he's asked this question, like, what do you feel about the special military operation? So what would you, you know, answer if you were him? Of course, I mean, you would say, well, I think it's kind of relevant. It's probably inevitable, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's how people answer, even if they are the embodiment of the opposition, moral opposition to Putin. There is no way you can get honest polling in Russia right now. That's reason number one. And second, even if you could get some honest answers via telephone, then all those polling organizations are controlled by the Kremlin. So they can play with the results like in any format they can.
Do people within Russia feel free at least to like share their true feelings with friends outside Russia over email? Or is there a sense that those communications are being monitored as well?
There is always that sense. And so the chilling effect is very real. Mm-hmm. And people, I'm going to say funny. It's not funny. It's tragic. It's very similar to how I remember the period where we had just left Soviet Russia in late 1970.
Sure.
And there was communication back home with people who were, but family members, right? Nobody with whom you would have any consternation about being honest if you were sitting at the dinner table. But it was understood that mail was being read. Phones were being tapped. Obviously, there was no internet at that time, but it was just understood that there was no such thing as a private conversation. And then, when you're with your friends, it was well understood that it's something like one out of three people were informing the KGB of what was going on, and it was impossible to know who your true friends are. So, other than say, like literally your family members and whoever you think your best friend is. That's the person with whom you're honest, and everybody else, you keep things as uncontroversial as you can.
And now here's an example from the recent history. I have a pretty large audience on my Facebook page, okay, and I post things. So I posted a short story about Navalny after his death. And I got this message via WhatsApp, again from my classmate, who said, you know, Stas, I just want you to know that I really love your posts. I love everything you write, and I'm thankful that you're writing about Alexei. I just wanted to say I'm sorry because there was no way I could put my like in your post. Because last time I did it, one of my colleagues at work reported on me. That that guy, you know, because people read each other's posts and reactions, and exactly like Jenna said, it doesn't necessarily take one to be a formal affiliate with FSB, KGB, security services. A lot of people just try to help.
So they have access to Facebook in Russia?
Well, by VPN.
Through VPNs.
So just the use of Facebook. Interestingly, your friend is violating Russia's laws just by using VPN to access Facebook, because Facebook has been extricated from the DNS tables and is no longer accessible via the regular internet means.
So in what does the internet look like in Russia?
Well, just like elsewhere in the world.
Yeah.
It's just there are certain services, again, like Meta, Facebook or Instagram, they were officially banned in Russia. But then again, you have this double moral because, I mean, every single member of the Russian government has access to Facebook and Instagram. And you still have Russian propagandists who are using Facebook and Instagram for their propaganda purposes. Again, they're using it by VPNs or even without VPNs, some of them. But again, an average Russian could literally go to jail for using Facebook and posting something anti-war there.
Huh.
Yeah.
So, Samizdat Online, talk to me about the origins of your project.
So the origins of the project actually start with the word Samizdat itself, right? Samizdat, which most... a surprising number of Americans know that word, but they're over a certain age. they're my peers or older. But
I have to admit, when we first spoke, I didn't know what it meant.
Never heard about it. But no, it's interesting. I spoke, I'm not going to name him, but I spoke to a major technologist individual here in the States who is about 15 years younger than me. But he came from Russia as well.
Yeah.
And he speaks Russian. Like he's familiar with Russia, but he had never heard of Samizdat, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
It really matters which circles you're traveling. So Samizdat was a mechanism in Soviet Russia. It literally means self-publication, Samizdat, and it was the means by which Russians exchanged illegal, banned, censored content amongst themselves during the Soviet era. Initially, the materials would be smuggled in by various means, frequently from like Czechoslovakia, which is kind of It wasn't entirely inside the Iron Curtain, and the materials run. It wasn't like it was only political stuff. It was quite the. It was literature and music and everything else that was censored because in Soviet
Russia. Sylvester Stallone movies.
So absolutely. So I grew up, and my origin story as a human being is that I wound up leaving Soviet Russia because my father cured himself of tuberculosis, which by means of learning yoga. And where did he learn yoga? In Samizdat, right? Like, because yoga is a...
yoga was forbidden.
It was forbidden, right? It's an anti-Marxist mind-altering... the thing is, once this is like...
Yoga was believed to be a religion.
Okay.
And so Soviet Union was an atheist society.
Yeah.
It was an ideology, right? It doesn't have to be... It was a religion, but it doesn't have to be a religion, right?
Anything it competed with the Marxist
ideology. It cleared the mind,
yeah.
Right? And then people would start asking questions, and that's not a good thing, right?
Yeah.
So whenever you enter that kind of zealotous information environment, everything is dangerous to it, which interestingly intersects with everything that you guys are doing. So I'm very familiar with Samizdat because, again, like it's because of Samizdat that we wound up... leaving Soviet Russia. Obviously, the anti-Semitism didn't help. But when the war broke out, and I have this kind of core understanding that information and the access to information, good information, is the key to a healthy society. Like the reason that the Russians are so easily, dragged by the nose into this conflict and have no bearings from which to protest or say, wait a second, what the hell are we doing? Like that, they are simply saddled with a narrative about something Nazis, something NATO, something Biden, something. We're going to war.
And they believe that?
They do.
Okay.
They do. And that shouldn't be surprising because the history of people believing stupid nonsense because they have no resources to access good information. That's the history of humanity, right? Like we are very easily led by the nose into all sorts of horrendous enterprises by various bad faith actors. I could name them. We all know them. So Putin is just playing from that playbook where as long as he is able to isolate the population within this, barrage of silliness, they believe it because it's presented in an incredibly compelling way, right? It sounds silly, right? I'm mocking it. But in fact, it is very highly produced, very elaborately put together. It's very well thought through. And just to give an example, like you see, not that it was interesting, but when you see Putin's conversation with Tucker Carlson,
right? I was going to ask you guys about that.
Well, so I'm happy to talk about it. But the key takeaway for me was that here's this guy who everybody knows who he is. Everybody understands that he's a mob boss, that he's a murderer, that he's an autocrat, you know, in the full sense of that word. And here he is being all, you know, right? And it's very easy to fall into the spell of, oh, yeah, well, here's the history of Russia, which is actually half the stuff he says is outright nonsense. But it doesn't matter. You kind of go along and he lulls you into this false sense of he knows what he's talking about, or he's got at least a reasonable point of view, right?
Everything is logical.
It's
and makes
logical,
sense
yeah.
in his world.
Yeah, in his world.
So once you're in his world, then everything is justified.
Yeah.
Assassinations. Him being this mafia boss, invading Ukraine, fighting the United States, probably World War III. Everything makes sense once you're in his world. And the reason why you are in his world is because you are fed with all that kind of information that only proves every point he makes.
Yeah. So this is the mindset that I come to this with, right? Like that as long as this is the only information these people will have, then the outcome is a foregone conclusion. There will be conflict, there will be war, and worse. So I'm thinking, what can I do, right? And I have this because I'm a technologist, and I have some of these political ideas and some very tangential connections into this world. Like, I don't come from this world, right? The world of advocacy, the world of politics. But I weirdly, serendipitously, throughout the course of my life, because I started my tech career at CBS News, and so I have this foothold in Western journalism and some connectivity to it. So it occurs to me that the thing I can do is I can build a thing that would simply sidestep Putin's narrative and give people the ability to simply engage in reality, right? There are dozens and dozens of these, what we're going to call them, oppositional media companies who are now living in exile but still operating in full force. They are professional journalists who've yeah. spent decades being professional journalists, and they're continuing to be professional
are there
journalists.
Are a lot of them here in the United States?
Very few are in the United States. There are ones in Latvia, in Holland, in Germany. Friends of ours who are operating literally, I guess in the United States, they're on a beach in Hawaii, right? They're
living in a tent.
Living in a tent. There's a journalistic couple. They get scooped all the time because they have all the latest breaking stuff because they've got people on the inside who feed them information. But that's the kind, like, it's very scrappy, very kind of like real journalism, right?
Yeah.
So, and I'm like, these are the voices that the Russians need to actually have access to, and that the people outside of Russia, either the expat Russians or just people who are keen to help, everyone's like, what can I do to help? Well, the thing you can do to help, if you're listening, if you're still listening, if we haven't bored you yet, the thing you can do to help is just get engaged with dissemination of information, right? Like we're one conduit to that. There are others, but we are we're a very easy way to get information into Russia, into Belarus, into Iran. If you know people who are in those areas and who need access, easy access, so that's how that was born. That was the idea. That's how I decided that I'm going to participate and help.
Well, can you talk about functionally how it works, like how you get this information to them to circumvent the censorship regime? Because I think it's pretty interesting technology.
It's not. It is incredibly uninteresting technology. It is
interesting to a layman like
No, it's really not even. I will now. So we really need to brace ourselves for everybody turning their podcast off now, because no, I will keep this very brief. So the interesting part is that there's tons of engagement, right? Like people really want to be able to participate in this project. So when you have these dozens of media operations and you bring them all together under one roof and you say, look, here's all of this incredibly engaging, insightful content that you here in the West don't see, right? You people should come and read Samizdat online, because they will suddenly be much more informed than they are based on whatever they're reading currently. And the technology itself, it simply taps into the way that the internet actually works, which is that if you, as an autocrat, you can turn off Facebook.com, NYTimes.com, right? You can turn those off. But if that information was coming through some other domain name, or as in our case, hundreds of domain names that keep changing continuously and keep evolving continuously and are just random letters that nobody would think to ban these domains preemptively, because there's, you know, tens of millions of domains floating around. You can't monitor them all. So they have to, a domain has to rise to the surface and be noticed as a domain under which some content that you are opposed to is flowing. And then as an autocrat, you could say, ah, that one, we're going to turn that one off. All right, fine. We're actually watching you turn it off, and we're going to spin up five more as you do, right? So, so it's a game of whack-a-mole that they can't win, right? Yeah. So from a technological perspective, that's all we're doing. It's actually not even, it's not even particularly clever.
It's brilliant in its simplicity.
It is. Oh, wow. Thank you. I'm going to use that from now on. It is. I am simpletonally brilliant. No, it is brilliant in its simplicity, but it's also the only way that it can be really undermined. It, and this is something that Putin is driving towards, is for them to literally turn the internet off, right? They can create, they're building what they're calling a chibernet. This is a word that your listeners will have never heard before, but now they're going to hear it all over the place, because this is something that Putin has been threatening to do for a while, and the chibernet is an entirely self-contained internet. And if they go that route, then our technology stops working there, just like it does not work in North Korea at this time, right? Because you need for the public to have access to the wider internet in order for us to operate successfully.
So if they identify one URL,
right,
that you guys put together, they can ban that, but then you spin up some other ones.
Correct.
I could give you an example of how my classmates are using it, for example.
Yeah, no, but let me ask, like, how do they get to these URLs in the first place, right? Because Stas, you had mentioned that on Christmas Eve in 2022, they had banned your website, right? So now folks need to have been shared one of these URLs by someone who had previously had access to your website.
Correct. So there are, yes, the initial engagement, the initial coming to grips or coming to know our project has to happen by some other means, right? So that somebody here hears this podcast, they say, oh, this sounds fantastic. Yeah. I have a brother in Kirkutsk. I'm going to send him a link. Right.
Yeah.
And the
link is not to Samizdat Online. It's to the one of the articles.
Correct.
That you feature.
Correct. Yes. This person is listening to this podcast wherever they're hearing this podcast. You know, in Wichita or you know, or in Los Angeles, and they go to the website. They find an article that's interesting, or they just they could send an encoded link to the website itself. Like circuitous, you know, self-referential link as well. And then that person could either, if they're not afraid to, you know, there has to be some level of bravery, but they have to sign up to our daily email, in which case we will then start sending them these links every day, and the links keep changing, and then they have an infinite resource. Or they can find us on Telegram, where we also provide a new link every day. Yeah. But at that point, it becomes a motivated reality, right? And the thing is that we're not really looking to solve that, because anybody who's already motivated, they do know how to use a VPN, and they're already fairly well informed. They're just going to be our entry point, right? Like, the person who's motivated is going to be the first person to find it, grab it, use it, and send it to that next person who doesn't know, and to whom this is some kind of revelation. I think Stas was about to mention an anecdote of his from his
I went to high school in a Russian city of Oryol, which is 200 miles southeast of Moscow. And most of my classmates joined the military later. So we have this WhatsApp chat called, you know, Boys from Our Backyard, where we correspond. We started this chat maybe 9 years ago. We congratulate each other on holidays, birthdays, and so on, share some, you know, funny stories, anecdotes, and so on. And so once the war broke out, of course, members of this chat divided into two parts: those who favored the war, those who were against the war. So we would have a lot of arguments. Like, one of the first arguments was those Putinists, pro-war classmates, they wrote, you know, all the atrocities you were talking about, like Bucha, for example. That was all staged. That was all staged in Hollywood. Nothing like that happened. Russian troops are not committing any atrocities in Ukraine. They're not killing civilians. Nothing of that's happening. Well, of course, they needed proof somehow. And since, again, Facebook and Instagram were banned, and there was no way they could get any information, they couldn't get access to New York Times investigations or other investigations which were conducted at the moment, I would simply send them those links, just links to certain stories, certain precise investigations on the matter. And eventually we ended up having at least two of my classmates change their mind about how the Russian army behaved. And then they were spreading those links subsequently through their, they were sending them to their parents and grandparents and friends and so on. And that's exactly how it works.
Yeah, it creates a contagion effect.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about, was there an opportunity to overthrow Putin with Yevgeny Prigozhin? And would that have been good for Russia? I mean, it seems like, it, just as an outsider who just knows what I read in the newspapers, like, this was a serious threat.
Well, you know, once the once the opportunity hasn't become a reality, you can always say that there was no opportunity, right?
Yeah.
There was no chance. But of course, at the same time, of course, there were chances. And if, I guess, if Yevgeny Prigozhin was stubborn enough, you know, in pursuing his goal. I mean, had his goal been actually seizing power in Moscow, he could have succeeded.
You think he could have?
But his goal was different. His goal was different. His goal was, again, to swear his loyalty to the chief, to Vladimir Putin, and to overthrow the Minister of Defense, Shoigu.
Yeah.
So he had a different goal. That's the point.
I was rooting for him because his name is Yevgeny. And I thought if he could finally, if somebody with a prominent position in Russia could, you know, become known, then telemarketers would stop screwing up my name when they call me, and that would be a win. No, the interesting thing is that it's been how many months now? Six months, right? Since that whole ordeal. In the moment
has
that it was happening.
Only been 6 months. Gosh,
has it been longer? Like, I don't know.
What was it? It was August of.
July.
It was July of 2023. Yeah, so. Yeah.
8 months. Whatever it is. In the moment, I remember us having these conversations where we were thinking, okay, is this a mortal wound for Putin? Right. It doesn't matter what the outcome is in terms of will Prigozhin, you know, accede him or be assassinated or whatever. But the fact that this happened, the fact that there was this level of danger, right? Like they were within some miles of Moscow, you know, with this operational force, and nobody was there to stop them. And then, like, if they rolled into Moscow, there's no military
in
Moscow.
It was
so
weird.
The police,
it was so weird. Yeah.
Like who would intercede? Like, and this seemed like an obvious mortal wound for Putin, right? And at the time, we were like, there's no way he can recover reputationally having shown this level of weakness. And the fact that he murdered him a couple of weeks later didn't, like, it, who cares? Like, that, like, it seems like the king's been exposed as an empty, you know, as a paper tiger. And yet, here we are, what, 8 months or whatever it is later.
Well,
and,
actually, he came up with strengthening his positions in Russia, Putin, I mean. Because, you know, millions of Russians saw what Putin does to traitors. So it was, again, a mobster message to the crowd. Like, I'm still strong. I control the situation. I'm in charge of everything.
Prigozhin had to know that was going to be the outcome, though, once he started moving toward Moscow. So why would he stop?
I think so.
It's like, die is cast,
well,
right? You've crossed the Rubicon.
His line of thought, that what he was doing was not a riot against Putin. It was not a rebellion against Putin's authority. Rather, it was just an attempt to make Vladimir Putin see the actual state of things. You know, how corrupt the army became, how weak the Minister of Defense became, and that a lot of changes needed to be introduced to the way the army functioned, the way the army fought in Ukraine.
But also his
fate
was
sealed.
So
to him, it was like, I'm helping the emperor.
No, but you know? Yes, but his fate, we're forgetting now that when this all happened, he was as good as dead at that moment, right? Before it happened. Like he was already... Like,
before he had taken over those army bases, before he started...
Correct.
Marching or driving to Moscow.
Weeks before that.
Okay.
He came to the conclusion quite correctly that they were like that all like his operation, what is its name,
Wagner,
the Wagner was about to be nationalized and incorporated into the larger Russian military. Shoigu was going to become the leader. He was going to become a useless pawn, and then immediately thereafter, he would either be murdered or just sidelined. Like it was a last ditch mechanism to try to regain his pertinence or relevance in the whole thing. But I'm sure that he understood that this was a massively risky thing to do. But I think it was just
again, partially. Remember this film with starring Tom Cruise called The Last Samurai?
Yeah.
Right? So, the leader of the samurai rebellion, Nahimoto was his name, who actually wanted to show the emperor that the country was not going in the right direction. Whereas at the same time, he was very loyal to the emperor. And he believed he was a servant to the emperor. He believed he was doing him a favor by launching that rebellion. So,
suggesting that Tom Cruise should play
Prigozhin, similar with Prigozhin anyway.
If you're suggesting Tom should play Prigozhin in the Hollywood adaptation of what happened, I agree. I think
he could. Yeah. He probably could.
So, Stas,
I prefer Brad T. But
I want to ask you, Stas, briefly about kind of the progression of Putin's regime in Russia, because it was a fairly free society relative to what it is now, right? There was an independent media at some point in Russia, wasn't there?
Well, in the first few years of the new millennium, yep.
What happened?
You
worked in that media.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, this has been actually one of the most rapid pivots in modern history from a free society to a police state. That's what happened to Russia in the past 24 years. And yes, in the 90s, Russia was probably, I would even say, a freer society in a sense than the United States. Because the Soviet Union had collapsed, mm-hmm. and Russians believed that there was no way they could ever become an authoritarian society again, having suffered the 70 years of communism. And what happened was a series of compromises made by journalists, a set of compromises where they, again, believed that their material well-being was more important than the freedom of the word in Russia. Seriously, I mean, the choices were as simple as that in the first place. And then when Putin came to power, he realized, the first official document, which was called the Information Doctrine of Russia, that was the first official doctrine of Russia passed in 2000. I think it was passed in the fall of 2000, the year 2000. It was not the defense doctrine. It was not security doctrine. It was called information security doctrine. So Putin realized that control of information was crucial to his staying in power as long as he could. And I would say that his plan was to, when he came to Kremlin, he came there for good. That was his plan. And so what he started doing first, the Kremlin got control of all the national television stations, then all national radio stations, then all national newspapers. And then step by step, the progress, what was happening was like this, you know, this story about the frog in a pot.
Yeah.
Right? When, if there's boiling water in the pot and you throw the frog there, the frog will jump out. Right, but if you warm the water up steadily, that's exactly what happened to the Russian society. Putin was abridging the freedoms steadily. He didn't take all the freedoms away all at once. This was happening year after year. Like in the first decade, again he got all the mass media in Russia under Kremlin's control, and then in the first decade. In the second decade, the Kremlin became working with the mindset of the Russian people persuading them that Russia was in danger, that Russia was actually fighting the West, that this was a civilization struggle, that the West was vicious, that the West planned on conquering Russia, and all that bullshit. So first you get control of the media, and then you brainwash your population using that media as a tool. And that's what happened. I mean, a lot of Russians believed that, and a lot of Russians were actually happy to believe that. Basically, Putin's major victory, as far as the mindset of Russians is concerned, was tying his own political well-being to the feeling of self-dignity, self-importance of the Russian people. Again, imagine you are an average Ivan living in Russia, somewhere in Siberia. You're 40-something years old, and
so you just retired.
Your life is not working out. You have a family. You're kind of tired. You're bored. You have to pay your mortgage. You don't have a destination in life, and you're tired. And then suddenly he comes to you and says, "You know what? Your life is not wasted. You can be a part of something truly big. You can be a part of this great war against this vicious West." And every next step you hear of is an essential step in this war. Like we kill Boris Nemtsov. You know why we kill him? That opposition leader who was shot in front of the Kremlin in 2015. You know why we did that? Because he was a traitor, because he was working for the West. He was this fifth column who was working against us inside the country. You take part in this opposition rally, you are, again, you are in the rows of our enemies.
I just want to say that this is so very, this is exactly, like, I know that in the West, in America in particular, people are very, they don't realize that this frog is being, that they are the frog in the pot that is being boiled here right now. Like, this is all
Westerners?
Westerners, right? This is what is happening in the States. It's just that the very, very early stages, we haven't started to see media be co-opted or true censorship, people being sent to prison for things they think. That thing that is starting to happen in Great Britain, right? I mean, Konstantin Kissin on his show was talking about how the British people are being, I mean, they're not being sent away for years, but they're being arrested for things they're saying on social media, right? Like, so the Brits are some steps ahead of us in that regard. But everything that Stas is just describing, right? Like this, people living in some level of discomfort, not enough discomfort to start a revolution, right? Mm-hmm. But enough discomfort where they don't have meaning, they don't have sense, they feel something is off, and then somebody comes along and says, "I'm going to give you a purpose," right? So you certainly, white supremacists have been doing this for many decades. Islamists have this game plan. Mm-hmm. But at this point, Americans are being subsumed from both sides, right? Like the left has its mantra of "we're going to show you how to finally find meaning." The right has its analog, and people are willing to give up their freedoms, their rights, in the name of this grander purpose. The means justify the ends justify the
means.
And also,
remember Benjamin Franklin said, "If you are ready to sacrifice your freedom for the sake of your security,
yeah, you'll get neither.
Yeah, you'll lose both."
Right.
And so that's exactly what happened to Russians, because Putin's initial message was, "Hey guys, you know, we're so tired of reforms. We need stability. We need confidence in the future, and I'll give you that. But yes, for the sake of that, we'll need to sacrifice."
He was promising to make Russia great again. Was that what he
absolutely
was doing?
Absolutely. I mean, that's that. When I first heard Donald Trump using the expression "Make America Great Again," I was like, "Jesus, I've heard this already." Because Putin's major message was, "Let's help Russia get off its knees," as if Russia once stood on its knees. But that was the message, that Russia had to stand on its knees before the West in the 90s. And now we gotta, you know, get up from our knees and make Russia great again, the great empire, the kind of empire it's been for centuries. And I mean, the reference Zhenya is making I'm right now writing a book called Russian Dreams, Russian Nightmares, exactly how Russia turned from democracy to a police state and how the media helped do that. I mean, there was no way Putin could have done what he did without the help of the media. And what is media? Media consists of journalists, of individuals. So I personally witnessed how Russian journalists made all those sacrifices, how they made their moral choices. So the story of the Russian media, the story of cheating on their mission, of cheating on their job. And things very similar to that are happening in this country right now. Something like this I can see happening to journalists. Some of this I see happening to politicians. Like, look what Trump did to the Republican Party, where now, you know, a lot of Republicans, even those who disagree with him and those who would oppose him, they choose to be silent because what happens when he becomes president, or if he becomes president, yeah. Right? So they're afraid, they're sacrificing their freedom of expression for the sake of their personal careers. And that's exactly what happened in Russia 20 years ago, 15 years ago, and that's exactly what made today possible.
Have you guys read Peter Pomerantsev's book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible,
yeah,
about Russia? I thought that was a fascinating book, and one of the contentions that he has, or one of the main themes, is that there is just so much information and so much of it is bullshit that nobody knows what to believe.
Yeah, and this is...
And
this
it
is,
creates cynicism
this
within
is
the society.
This is Putin's primary objective, and has been, right? Like, this operational tactic of creating so much noise, right? The other person who talks about this a great deal is Garry Kasparov, to create so much noise that people are exhausted by it and they lose interest in trying to whittle out what is true and what isn't. I am not writing a book, but if I were to write a book, it would be called The Age of Babel, where we've entered into a place where there are so many areas of expertise, there's so many things within which one could be an expert, that it is impossible to be an expert in more than one or at most two things. But you have to live your life, right? You have to know, do I take a vaccine? Don't I take a vaccine? Yeah. Is it safe to get on an airplane? Is it not safe to get on an airplane? Is the globe getting warmer? Is it not getting warmer? And you see people who are experts taking diametrically opposed views on this. And you as the layperson say, what am I supposed to do here, right? I can't operate in this I want to know, and these are important matters in which I should have a position, but I don't know who I should believe. And if you have enough of this, then again, getting back to Putin's, sort of wet dream of a world in which you just then have a culture of personality, right? So you love Donald Trump, you're going to believe what Donald Trump says. He was setting this up. I wrote a piece about this for The Bulwark 4 years ago, when he was setting up this precedent where, believe me, it doesn't matter that the CIA, who works for me, is saying something that is 180 degrees different from what I'm saying. You're going to believe me. I'm telling you that they're wrong. Putin's right. They're wrong. MBS is telling the truth. My intelligence operatives are misleading you. It's the deep state, right? Now, again, like, unless you somehow have access to the people working at the State Department, and even if you have access to those people, they're going to disagree amongst themselves. Like, you can't know. So then you just, in Putin's world, you believe Putin. Right? Because he's just going to be the cipher, and you just trust me. I know what I'm doing, and you're all going to be great. The problem is that it doesn't work like that, right? Like, I mean, things fall apart very quickly.
And that's the point, but nobody cares how it actually works. You know, Margarita Simonyan, who is editor-in-chief of RT, and she is one of the Kremlin's chief mouthpieces at the moment, she put it very simply to the Russians. You love the boss, you love the country, and you'll be okay. You'll thrive. And then her message, her other message was, you know what? After all, life sucks. And no matter where you are in this world, things are going wrong. This world is going nowhere. And Americans are not much better than us. Yes, they have kind of less corruption, but not really, you know. And so humans are vicious creatures by nature everywhere in the world. So we just got to, take care of ourselves.
This is Margarita Simonyan. So, these
yes,
are not your points.
Yes, this is Margarita Simonyan
well,
saying.
But,
so
yeah.
If we live in Russia, let's just, stand behind Putin Let's group around Putin and let's fire the America and the rest of the world because that's how.
Well, isn't that the argument that you hear from China and Russia, which is that democracy has essentially failed, it's corrupt, it can't accomplish anything, so why not try autocracy?
This drives me crazy, and because we, this is entirely our fault. I'm going to lay the blame at the West's fault, right? China has made, like, never mind that, you know, if the day we're recording this, China is in all sorts of trouble. But let's imagine that we were recording this 2 years ago when all the evidence was that China was just this absolute success story, having pulled hundreds of millions of people out of poverty and into a middle class, and everybody's thriving, everything's fantastic. Yeah, there's an autocracy, but who cares? Nobody. Xi's argument is that is the better way to run things, right? Mm-hmm. But nobody takes a step back and say, yeah, but how did they manage to do that? Oh, they became a really, really cheap factory to the West, which generated all the capital that actually funded all of this, all of this improvement, right? If they had to do this on their own, they would still be starving to death because their mechanisms don't work. And Putin's Russia, which isn't as well funded by the West and has to, you know, and at least they have oil and gas to sell, but that's it. They're a giant petrochemical resource that,
They can't fix their airplanes.
They can't. Well, again, this is 2 weeks after Boeing's doors are flying off the plane.
Can't fix our airplanes either.
But the point is that, like, there is only one proven way to lead a successful society, and that is through a free, liberal, democratic, open thought, knowledge-based society, right? Knowledge-based societies work because people invent cool things and then start selling them to each other and everybody thrives. Is it perfect? Far from it. But the fact that China was able to position itself as like this, you know, success story, like nobody takes one step further back and says, yeah, but they're only a success story because it was funded by
Francis Fukuyama's The End of History.
Right.
Any authoritarian society can show a success story at some point for the time being, like the Soviet Union in the 30s, you know, a country becoming an industrialized nation from an agricultural backward nation some 20 years before then. But it's always a matter of the price you pay, right? Mm-hmm. Like the Soviet Union paid the price of tens of millions of lives for that. And China, by the way, has paid a huge price of, again, millions of lives for their success story. And by the way, then the success story is always short. Like in terms of history, the 70 years of the existence of the USSR is nothing. It's just a moment, right? So,
and it was running on fumes for the last 25 years of those 70 years, right? So it really ran out of gas very, very quickly.
So I mean, people forget the lessons of history very fast in all countries because the advantages. I mean, Churchill again said that democracy is the worst thing, but there is nothing better when it comes to running the country. So and the West and the Western
said that
exactly
too.
The Western democracy has proved that. It is stronger.
But for all the others, right?
Absolutely. So.
Well, how can folks help?
So there are a multitude of things people can do. First of all, we need money. And that's always true for everybody.
And what's the website URL?
So the website is samizdotonline.org. Okay. I'm assuming you guys have...
Yeah, we'll link it in the show notes. Yeah.
Notes. The other way that you can help, I'm imagining that the audience for this show are, you know, very well-educated, very well-positioned, very people really interested in freedom of expression, right? Given who you guys are. And so to the extent to which they have any capacity to, you know, introduce us, like we seem like we're very well-established, the website looks very pretty and so forth, but we're actually, you know, we're just a few people. Very scrappy, very, you know, get up and go. But if you know somebody who you think I should be introduced to, please introduce. I'm looking right at the camera. Please contact me. Please, you know, just get in touch. Help us spread the word. You know, it's surprising how easy it is to help us at this stage. So you know, and yes, at the very least. Subscribe to donate, you know, $5 a month. It's what we're doing is well worth it, and it won't hurt you. And who knows, maybe we'll bring down the Iranian regime and the Russian regime and the Chinese regime and the world will be a perfect place to live.
We could only wish. Stas, Jenya, I appreciate you both coming on the show.
Nico, thank you so much
for
having
us.
Next time you're in D.C., you'll have to come back.
Absolutely. This is great.
The website is samizdat.org.
Samizdat.online.
Samizdat.online.org. And we will have it linked in the show notes. I encourage everyone to check it out. Again, this podcast is hosted by me, Nico Perino, and produced by Sam Niederholzer and myself. It's edited by my colleagues, Aaron Reese, Chris Malpe, and Ella Ross. You can learn more about So to Speak by checking us out on any of our social media channels. We also have video of this conversation and other conversations on our YouTube channel. And you can email us feedback at sotospeak@thefire.org if you want to get in touch with Jenya Stas. You can shoot me an email, and I'll do my best to get them in touch with you guys. If you enjoyed this episode, we encourage our listeners to leave us a review, Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Those reviews help us attract new listeners to the show. Until next time, I thank you all again for listening.